This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate you taking some time this afternoon to come join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with us live, I'd invite you to go to the show page, and if you scroll down near the bottom, that's where you'll find the chat room. That is the perfect place if you have some observations about the show that you would like to share with some of the regulars, or if there is a question you would like for us to ask our guest that it appears that we're not quite heading in that direction. That's a great place to put it in. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'll be glad to steal your ideas and call them our own and fold it in as we move along. And if you have to run off halfway through the show and you want to catch up on what you missed, or you just want to catch up on some previous episodes of Midrats, you can always subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes, or, of course, you can get the full archive at Blog Talk Radio. And let's go ahead and dive into the show. And kind of like the nation that is the subject of today's show, she never really goes away, even though you're not paying attention to her. The claims of hundreds of years old in the South China Sea are once again being brought to the front. We're also seeing ethnic tensions that date back well before recorded time from a European perspective that are again driving front page news. And regardless of what might be happening in the Middle East, Europe, China and the nations that border the South China Sea have their own set of priorities that they have been pursuing and will continue to pursue whether we wish to have it above the fold or not. And our guest today is just one of the perfect people to have on board to discuss that. He's a returning guest and a great China expert, Dr. Toshi Yoshihara from the Naval War College. Professor Yoshihara is the John A. Van Buren Chair of Asia-Pacific Studies and is an affiliate member of the China Maritime Studies Institute at the Naval War College. Before joining the college faculty, he was a visiting professor in the Strategy Department at the Air War College. Dr. Yoshihara has served as an analyst at the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis, RAND, the American Enterprise Institute as well. He has a Ph.D. from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy over at Tufts University and an M.A. from the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He is also a BSFS from the School of Foreign Service over at Georgetown. And he was the co-author, along with another one of our friends here, of Red Star Over the Pacific, China's Rise and the Challenge to U.S. Maritime Strategy. And over at the show page, you'll find a link not just to that book, but other books that he's written as well. And Toshi, I think we could do half the show with your CV, but I think we've got the bold-faced items. Welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on your show.
Really appreciate it. And I would kind of like to extend a couple of things that I brought up on the intro to give us a chance to set the table for a lot of our listeners who they only have 24 hours a day, obviously. And in the last year, the conversation in the national security arena has really been dominated by Russia returning to the scene, the goings-on Syria, the migrant crisis, how that's affecting Europe. Something happened on the way to the Pacific pivot. But the Pacific pivot and all those discussions on Westpac, the reasons behind it and the developments that were bringing that in such an important subject of discussion and work, they haven't changed, and they've continued marching forward. And, for the sake of our listeners and like I said, setting the scene for the rest of the show, in the course of the last year, for those people that have been focusing on Russia, they've been focusing on Central Asia, the developments in the Arab world, what are those things that in China and the countries that surround the South China Sea, What are the developments that have been taking place there that they need to catch up on?
Sure. What I would like to do, first of all, is to paint a broader geostrategic picture in terms of America's global strategy and the kinds of challenges that the United States is facing, particularly in maritime Asia. And I want to start with sort of our global strategy that we've had since the end of World War II, and I have described it based on the theoretical writings of geostrategists as the Rimland strategy. And what I mean by the Rimland strategy is that the United States has sought to maintain a favorable balance of power along the rimlands of Eurasia. And there are basically three main rimlands around Eurasia that the United States has paid very close attention to. And one is, of course, Western Europe. The other one is East, in particular, Northeast Asia. And not surprisingly, since the end of World War II, the United States has maintained a series of formal alliance treaties, whether it's in the form of NATO or in the form of formal bilateral treaty alliances with Japan, South Korea, and others, that has allowed the United States to essentially maintain a dominant position and a favorable balance of power in those two rimlands of Eurasia. And then there's the southern rimlands, you might call it, and that's the Middle East, where the United States also, since the end of World War II, has maintained close ties with Israel and other important regional powers there to maintain a favorable balance of power. And I think what we've seen over the past 18 to 24 months is a deterioration of those balances of power across all three rimlands. And the fact that the United States is facing challenges in the European rimland with what Russia has been doing in Ukraine, and also its increasing growing influence and encroachment in the Middle East as well. And of course, in the Middle East with Syria on fire, etc., we can see that the western and the southern rimlands have become increasingly destabilized, where our favorable balance of power is shifting away from us. And then, of course, that has in turn made it very difficult for us to conduct the pivot to Asia that would enable us to basically shift our resources, both military, diplomatic, and political and economic, to the Asia-Pacific region. And so while we had determined since at least 2012 that we wanted to conduct the pivot, these two other very important parts of the world, namely the Middle East and Europe, keeps pulling us back in. And I think that's partly one of the reasons for why many people complain about why the pivot to Asia has been under-resourced. And again, you know, because our day-to-day attention typically is focused on the crisis of the day, our national security apparatus, I think, is often geared towards resolving a crisis of the day, we then have not been able to focus our attention on the longer-term challenge, in my view, which is the rise of China, which I think is truly what's going to alter the balance of power in the Asia-Pacific in ways that we haven't seen in many decades. And so I think that's kind of the overall picture, which is the United States, as the still sort of globally dominant power, has to manage these three regions simultaneously. And yet all three places are being challenged in ways where we cannot focus our attention in one place alone. And the challenge of balancing our resources and our commitments across these three regions, I think, is going to be the challenge of our time, and it's going to be the challenge that the next presidential administration will face, which is how do we balance our resources in a way that allows us to maintain a favorable balance of power across both Europe, Middle East, and the Asia Pacific. And so that's kind of the big picture setting. And then what I want to do now is to talk a little bit about China's growing assertiveness in maritime Asia over the past 18 months or so, and what that might mean for the United States. So as I think most of the people are familiar with, is China's island buildup in the South China Sea. And I think the thing that has made the headlines most recently is China's deployment of a surface-to-air missile in the Paracels. And so what we've been seeing, at least since 2014, perhaps earlier, is a rapid buildup of China's presence in the South China Sea. They've been building up islands, literally dredging up sand from the seabed of the South China Sea and creating these artificial islands in the Spratlys, in the heart of the South China Sea. And I think this, in many ways, has given China a permanent foothold and an initiative that China has not had in the past. So that's probably one of the biggest developments that we've seen in maritime Asia. But at the same time, what China has been doing is to continue to prod and challenge Japan over the Senkaku Islands in the south, in the East China Sea, where the Chinese have regularly deployed their Coast Guard vessels to challenge Japan's administrative control around the waters surrounding the Senkaku Islands. What we've also seen, of course, is China's naval and military modernization that we are now beginning to see in full view. In particular, the Chinese had a massive military parade last September commemorating China's quote-unquote defeat of Japan during World War II. And, you know, we can dispute the historical veracity of that claim. But during the parade, the Chinese rolled out a whole host of new military capabilities that I think caught many people off guard. In particular, the unveiling of the DF-26 medium-range anti-ship ballistic missile that supposedly has the range to hit Guam. We are also seeing a steady modernization of the Chinese Navy. The Chinese have been cranking out frigates and destroyers. We are now seeing the fruits of that serial production. And so the naval balance of power is also shifting in China's favor in recent years. And that has in turn, all of these things, China's greater assertiveness in maritime Asia, in its growing power, its growing willingness to enforce its claims in disputed waters and territories, have led to a series of regional reactions. The United States, for example, has conducted freedom of navigation operations to dispute China's excessive maritime claims. We are also seeing regional ties being forged, new regional ties being forged with the United States, countries ranging from, say, Vietnam all the way to Myanmar, you know, countries that we typically wouldn't think would be aligned with the United States are, I think, coming out more openly to align themselves in a way that puts themselves geostrategically in a favorable position vis-a-vis China. But we're also seeing a lot of these frontline states beginning to modernize their military, beginning to take the China challenge much more seriously, ranging from Japan, Australia, Philippines, and Vietnam. All of them have, I think, really awoken to this China challenge. And a whole series, I think, of regional alignments are happening right now. Too many, really, to discuss this afternoon. But there's a lot of activity going on in this part of the world as a result of China's rise. So that's kind of my broad overview, which is sort of America's global strategy and China's impact on this global strategy.
Well, let's take a look at the historical reasons why China is, I mean, we might have covered this before, but it's always worth going back to. Some research I've been doing indicates that China views the Opium Wars, or at least they use an excuse, the Opium Wars, as a reason why they were humiliated, and that a lot of what we're seeing today seems to be their effort to overcome that and to become a great power. And as a consequence, they have been studying our strategist Mann and Wiley and Corbett and a bunch of other folks, mm-hmm. and the history of the great powers to how, you know, is that that historical review they're doing, is that driving the approaches they're taking to say in an effort to turn the South China Sea into their Caribbean or a Chinese lake, or is there something even more behind this that we don't know about?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the driving, to ask the question, why is China doing this? I think history is a core component of China's rationale in terms of its greater assertiveness. And I think you pointed to one driving force, and that is their historical interpretation of the so-called century of humiliation that began in the mid-1800s and didn't end until the People's Republic was stood up in 1949. And the lesson that they learned from that century of humiliation is that it was China's weakness at sea during the Qing Dynasty's period of decline and decay that led to the outgrowth of Western imperial aggression against China, that it was because China was not able to resist Western imperial aggression, which all came from the sea, that led to this these series of encroachments made by Western imperial powers. And what's remarkable is that there's, in fact, a consensus number in China's scholarly and strategic community about just how many times China was attacked from the sea during the Century of Humiliation. And the consensus number is 470. 470 times. So 470 invasions, large and small, from the sea during the Century of Humiliation. And so you can tell just by that little data point that the Chinese are counting. You know, they've got sort of a chip on their shoulder that they've been wronged in history. And most of those aggressions have come from the sea. So the lesson is to prevent this from happening ever again, right? To right this historical wrong, China has to be strong at sea so that China will never be humiliated again. And this view has been articulated by the Chinese, by the commander of the Chinese Navy today. Admiral Wu Shengli has articulated this point. So this historical imperative is very powerful. And also that the quite ambitious nine-dash line claim that the Chinese make over 80% of the South China Sea, part of the claim of the extent of the nine-dash line is based on what the Chinese call historic rights. Now, it's not very clear what the Chinese mean precisely by historic rights. What rights are conferred on China based on historic rights? But what the Chinese argue is that Chinese mariners, since ancient times, have plied those waters and have discovered the islands, have made use of the islands, have fished in those waters well before any other claimants arrived on the scene. And so, therefore, by implication, because of this historical precedent of China's long-term presence in this body of water, this somehow confers China some additional inherent rights to the Chinese to use the seas. Again, the Chinese are not very clear precisely what those rights are, but they make a very strong historical argument. And this is a very important point because we make legal arguments, right? We talk about freedom of the sea. We talk about the rights of all seafaring nations to access and use the seas. The Chinese make the argument that these legal arguments are legal arguments that derive from Western tradition, from Western history, from Western law, and that for China to basically have its own prerogatives in maritime Asia, that China's historic rights have to be taken account in this body of water. And so the Chinese would say the U.S. argument, at least, is a sort of a Western legal argument about something in which China can dispute through China's own historical perspective. And they would argue that we have to start from history first before we talk about the law. And so in my view, this would suggest that this dispute over the legal status of the islands or the waters around those islands are deeply rooted in a very different worldviews about sort of, you know, where do rights come from, for example. These very basic questions arise from very different worldviews. And so in my view, this historical lens offers at least a sense of just how deeply entrenched China's position is. And I don't expect China's position to change. In fact, I would argue that China's position, based on its historical interpretation and based on its own interpretation of the law, means that China's position would rather, in fact, harden over time rather than soften. So we've got a challenge on our hands where I think China's worldview is much more entrenched, I think, than we would prefer to see. And so history is a huge deal. And again, the other point that you make is China's learning from history about Western theorists. I think that's also a very important point, is that the Chinese are very, in some ways, introspective in terms of the reading of history. And I've always been impressed by Chinese theorists and Chinese writings that take a very conscious look both at their own history but also the historical experiences of previous sea powers. And they've been very studious. They've been great, very good students of history, trying to draw lessons from this history, whether it's Mahan or Corbett, the sea power theorists in the West, as well as the rise and fall of previous sea powers. But I think what's interesting to note here is exactly what lessons are they learning? In other words, you know, they, you know, they may be very studious. They may have had deep study of these histories of sea power theories, as well as the rise and fall of previous sea powers. But have they actually learned the right lessons, or have they learned false lessons from those history? I think that's still an open question, because if they falsely read the lessons, then they could very well commit the same mistakes that previous sea powers have committed, including, for example, Wilhelmine Germany prior to World War One.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more than that. The historical aspect of this, and by historical, you've got to move the decimal point over at least one, maybe two spots from how most people are used to looking at history to really try to get a mind around the Chinese view of it. And you can even come to, well, at least I guess the Chinese perspective is something recent, because not just look at their historical grievance, but as with many organizations in life, if you're trying to figure out what they're trying to do, read what they're actually publishing about it. What are they discussing about? And one of the touchstones I wanted to bring into the conversation here is Deng Xiaoping's, lack of a better phrase, his CNO in the early 80s, Admiral Liu Huaqing, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, he outlined back there in the first Reagan administration kind of a three-step strategy for China with a real long view. The first goal was for them to break the first island chain, the Kuril Islands in Japan through Taiwan. Step two, break through the second island chain, which would be interesting because Guam's in that. And then finally, at some point, maybe mid-century here, for China to become a no-kidding global blue water navy with global power projection capability. And a couple things I wanted to run by you, Toshi, is how does their creation of the Sand Islands recently play into that? Is it part of that, or just a opportunistic addendum to it? And are they roughly progressing along the same lines Admiral Huaqing put out for them back in the 1980s?
Yeah, I think that's actually a very important baseline with which to measure how well China is doing, how fast is China progressing in terms of their larger maritime ambitions. And I think what's important to note about Admiral Liu Huaqing is that he was in many ways entrusted by Deng Xiaoping to articulate a long-term naval and maritime strategy for China. And the underlying reason is not simply for the sake of building China's navy and modernizing China's navy. It was very much tied to the rise of Chinese sea power, the Mahanian definition of sea power, which is a much more comprehensive understanding of sea power. It's not just a big navy. It's the development of all of the implements of national maritime power to advance China's long-term national goals. China's goals, for example, to become a major power in East Asia, and China's goal to become increasingly integrated into the global economy. And that really was the driving force. You know, Deng Xiaoping came to power and decided to open China up, to allow China to become a member of the U.S.-led international order and the U.S.-led economic order. And so what he entrusted to Liu Huaqing wasn't just the buildup of the Navy, but how does the Navy serve China's longer-term interests as it becomes integrated into this U.S.-led economic order? And so the imperative there is a far-seeing judgment, I think, on the part of Deng and on the part of Admiral Liu Huaqing, that as China's growing commercial interests extends into the far corners of the world, that China will need the sea power, not just the Navy, but the other implements of maritime power, including the fishing fleet, the merchant marine, as well as maritime law enforcement, all of the implements of maritime power to support China's rise. And so this is very much connected to China's longer-term goals, recognizing that as China expands its economic interests overseas, that it will need sea power to support and protect those interests. And again, what we're seeing today is coming to fruition of that vision, which is that China's capabilities now are finally matching up with this longer-term goal. And, you know, again, what, you know, what we're seeing is a Chinese Navy that can defend many of its interests inside the so-called First Island Chain and perhaps beyond. China now has a emerging expeditionary maritime force that can project power into the Indian Ocean. The anti-piracy patrols that's been going on remarkably since 2008 has been uninterrupted. We've had flotillas replacing one after the other continuously since 2008 to this very day, something that I think many people back in 2008 would have said you were crazy if you told them that they would be doing this, you know, 8 years later continuously. And they also have a large fishing fleet, a very large merchant fleet. They have now, as we know, one of the largest maritime law enforcement fleets in the region. And so, again, I think this strategy, Admiral Liu Huaqing's strategy of the First Island Chain, Second Island Chain, and beyond, I think provides that benchmark in terms of how China will seek to basically control its destiny in the maritime domain. Now, you know, there are some sort of interesting intellectual questions worth asking, and this is a question I often ask my students at the Naval War College, which is, you know, this concept of the First and Second Island Chain in some ways bespeaks a very continental mindset, right? Because this is basically a very Sinocentric worldview where a continental power like China is literally drawing lines at sea, using geography as a way to demarcate a particular maritime boundary. The first island chain running from the Kurils through Japan down to the Philippines, and then the second island chain that runs from the Japanese islands through the Marianas that wends its way back into Southeast Asia. And one kind of intellectual question worth asking is whether this continental mindset of drawing lines at sea, this approach in which China is literally extending its terrestrial defense from the Chinese coastline out into the maritime domain, is actually conducive to, or perhaps even an impediment to, China's intellectual development as a genuine, you know, blue water sea power. So one might say that, you know, perhaps the more the Chinese talk less of First Island Chains, perhaps that might be an intellectual sign that China is, in fact, in their mindset, in their approach to the seas, becoming a genuine blue water navy. On the other hand, I'm not sure that China can kind of step away from the First Island Chain just because of the nature of maritime geography. You know, the other argument that I always make to my students at the Naval War College is that, you know, God hasn't been kind to China when it came to maritime geography. You know, the First Island Chain is a literal physical barrier to China's maritime ambitions. The Chinese view the First Island Chain in strategic terms because of U.S. bases, mostly on the Korean Peninsula and on the Japanese islands, as well as the alliance architecture that's represented by U.S. ties with countries along the First Island Chain. The First Island Chain also forms a series of choke points that Chinese mariners, whether they're commercial or military in nature, must pass through one of those choke points in order to reach the high seas of the Pacific or the Indian Ocean. And, of course, that has led many Chinese to be very anxious about the possibility that an outside power like the United States might seek to choke off China from its access to seaborne commerce, which is so essential to its economic well-being. So, on the one hand, you might say that China stepping away from the First Island Chain might represent kind of an intellectual evolution on the part of their naval strategists. On the other hand, the fact of the matter is China will never be able to get away from the First Island Chain in a very physical sense, and so therefore they do have to engage with the First Island Chain as a strategic problem. That's not going to go away anytime soon. And so, again, I think what Liu Huaqing has offered us, I think, is a very useful analytical framework to think about China's strategic priorities and the kinds of challenges that China will face. And again, I think the whole First Island Chain construct is a useful way for thinking about how China has to, first of all, be able to control events, to control its destiny over the bodies of water bounded by the First Island Chain, that would be the Yellow Sea, East China Sea, and the South China Sea, and that China's island buildup, the buildup of those facilities that look like they're going to be military-grade facilities in the heart of the South China Sea must be understood in that context.
Well, you know, I've got a couple of threads I want to pull here. One is, you know, earlier you talked about the Rimland strategy, which I think was Spikeman as part of his containment theory. But the other side of that was the Hartman theory that Mackinder had. Is it possible to look at what China's doing as they try and develop this body of water next to their homeland? Is this akin to a homeland lake for them that they need to have in order to maintain their existence on the what they view as a viable existence? Part, that's question one, and then you also mentioned World War One, and I noticed there was an article by one of your co-workers at the Naval War College in the National Interest about China's World War One master plan to take on the U.S. Navy, Lyle Goldstein, I guess, Goldstein. Are those
right.
two things connected? I guess is where I'm going with that.
Okay. So let me just say a few more things about the kind of the Rimland Heartland issue. What's also interesting, I think, within China's theory class is that they have paid very close attention to geopolitics and geopolitical theory, and that they have studied people like Mackinder and Spikeman and their theoretical contributions. And there's been an ongoing debate as to kind of what exactly is China? Is China a Rimland power, or is it more akin to a Heartland power? And I think one of the policy debates that have emerged that's in some ways parallel to this theoretical debate is China's so-called One Belt, One Road. And China's One Belt, One Road is I would call a hyper-ambitious long-term plan in which China is going to build up a series of economic ties, infrastructure ties, to essentially the different parts of the Eurasian landmass. And so the One Belt and the One Road basically sees a series of connections through the maritime domain, in other words, a series of maritime ties through the Indian Ocean that connects China's economic interest to, say, South Asia, to the Middle East, to the African continent, as well as all the way into Europe through the Mediterranean. So you will see these maritime arteries, essentially, where China is connecting its economic relations with all of the countries along the Indian Ocean littorals all the way into the Med. China is also seeking a very ambitious infrastructure buildup that would see China's economic centers connected across the Eurasian landmass, so through Central Asia, to connect China to Europe directly over land. China is taking essentially a dual-pronged approach where China is going to direct a lot of its investments and resources to the western part of its frontier, both through land and through sea. Now, this is a very long-term project. In fact, many Chinese interlocutors that I've spoken with say that its progress is going to be measured in terms of decades, and that this is going to be at least a half-century project, a very long-term project that will knit together China's economic relations with all of those countries through the maritime and through the continental arena. And I think what's really interesting about this is that it does, in some ways, resurrect the Heartland theory, especially the continental routes, the sort of, you know, resurrecting the old Silk Road, where China is connected to Europe through land. I think one of the things about that is that from a geostrategic perspective is that if this ever comes to fruition, and I have my own doubts because of the instability through which many of these routes would have to pass through, is that if this project comes to fruition, China will have achieved the nightmare scenario that Mackinder was so afraid of, right, which is a continental power that has essentially access through the continent to both sides of the Eurasian landmass. Now, he, of course, projected his fears on Russia at the time, but But if you look at the One Belt, One Road from a geostrategic perspective, that's what China is trying to do. And what Mackinder was afraid of course, is that the heartland would, over the long term, become impervious to the pressures of sea power, because the sea power cannot reach the heartland. And so China's long-term goal through the One Belt, One Road, particularly the continental route, is to be able to connect its trade relations with its very important economic powers in Europe and elsewhere through routes that are less dependent on the sea and therefore less vulnerable to, say, the hostile intent of the United States. Now, the way I would think about this is that it's a very high risk proposition, but potentially high reward over the long term if China actually achieved these goals. But again, I have my doubts, simply because the routes that they're talking about will likely pass through areas that are both very physically inhospitable, but also politically and economically very unstable, especially through Central Asia. I think what's very interesting is that this One Belt, One Road is resonating, I think, theoretically, in terms of this heartland versus rimland debate. Now, as for how this fits into, China's South China Sea strategy, certainly I think this feeds into this notion that China needs a buffer zone, essentially. And the way, again, the Chinese conceive the maritime frontier is in some ways very continental in nature, right? What they've done is to, in some ways, territorialize the sea. So, one of the phrases they like to use to describe the South China Sea, the near seas in general, is that they're blue national soil, which is the literal translation of blue territory, right? Which this view that these bodies of water right off China's coast is, in fact, part and parcel of Chinese territory. So this notion that China views these seas from a very continental mindset suggests that China does indeed want to make the South China Sea integral part of homeland defense, that it is very much part of a buffer zone. It's connected to the defense of the homeland. And the Chinese often talk about the fact that China has a very long coastline, and that China's major political and economic centers today are all located along the coast, and that increasingly these major political economic centers fall within the range of the long-range precision strike of American military power. And therefore, China needs to develop an infrastructure and weapon systems that allows China to create a no-go zone, a keep-out zone, so that that defensive perimeter is now beyond the reach of American firepower. And so if we think about the South China Sea as a potential buffer zone, that also puts the militarization of the South China Sea into clarity. Because, again, what I've argued in the past is that if the Chinese militarize those islands and deploy, for example, anti-access area denial weaponry onto those islands, what you have then are anti-access bubbles emerging in the heart of the South China Sea. But they're not anti-access bubbles on their own. They're anti-access bubbles that are now defended by a larger anti-access bubble that extends from the Chinese mainland. So you have basically layered anti-access umbrellas over the South China Sea. And I think that could potentially pose an access problem for both the United States and its allies. And if you look at it from that context, then the militarization of the South China Sea fits into this larger attempt at creating a maritime buffer zone, a keep-out zone, that the Chinese believe is necessary to defend the Chinese homeland.
Let's catch up on some of the nations that surround that South China Sea area, because one thing we've seen in the last year, and I'll kind of work my way counterclockwise, Vietnam, which I continue as a as an older cohort, Gen X guy, I always get a kick out of the fact that people can look at the option of, do I buy something made in China or Vietnam, and people grab the stuff from Vietnam and smile, and they are very welcoming of Americans. But Vietnam has become a little more assertive and continued to build relationships with the U.S. I think the feeling is very mutual there. Recently, we've seen the Philippines have not completely done a 180, but have changed at least the theme and the mood towards Americans based out of their country. And even more interesting is our friends in Japan, their adjustments in their view of not just selling military gear potentially, but perhaps projecting power has also developed a lot in the last year. How are those nations trending, and is the assumption of a desire for a closer and more integrated relationship with the U.S. from a national security perspective, is that a fair reading?
I think that is a fair reading, which is that many of the frontline states in maritime Asia are engaging in balancing behavior towards China, that they're aligning themselves with the United States, as well as, importantly, with each other to counterbalance China's growing assertiveness. And I'll go through these countries, and I would also add Australia into this larger picture. But Vietnam, I think, is an important player in this regard. First of all, it's important to note that Vietnam gave the Chinese bloodied the Chinese in the 1979 Sino-Vietnamese border war. The Vietnamese are known to be tough. They're tough fighters, and they have, as a small regional power, stood up to the Chinese. They have a record of doing that. And so I think from the perspective of will, I think that's certainly one historical indicator. But also Vietnam's geostrategic position is important to note. It is one of those regional states that not only has a contiguous border with China, but also has a maritime front. And so Vietnam arguably could put pressure on China in these two directions. And it's also important to note that Vietnam's physical proximity to one of China's very important naval bases on Hainan Island also potentially gives Vietnam some leverage. The Vietnamese, as we know, have now been purchasing, acquiring, and procuring its own set of anti-access weapons. Many of them, I think, are developed with China in mind, whether it's the procurement of the Kilo-class submarines. I think the Vietnamese purchase of anti-ship cruise missiles, for example, all of those types of anti-access capabilities could potentially pose a real challenge to the Chinese. Imagine, for example, a Vietnamese anti-access umbrella that extends essentially over Hainan Island. That's something that's certainly conceivable as we see the proliferation of long-range precision strike weaponry that's increasingly available to all kinds of militaries. And so, again, Vietnam's geostrategic position and the kinds of weaponry that it's producing could, in fact, pose a real challenge to the Chinese. The Philippines, I think, is also finally awoken, I think, to the Chinese challenge. And the Philippines has adopted a very interesting dual approach. It has, in some ways, attacked China diplomatically by taking China to court in The Hague about the maritime disputes. China now says that it's not going to recognize the authority of the Court of Arbitration in The Hague, and I think that's going to impose some reputational costs on China. Some Chinese say, "Well, we're too big, we're too important that we can ignore or we can." Basically say we don't care about what the rest of the world thinks, but I think they're putting on a brave face. I think that there is, in fact, some real reputational cost that can be inflicted on China if it continues to say that it doesn't recognize the final judgment of the Court of Arbitration. But the Philippines is also, I think, leveraging its alliance relationship with the United States to give the United States access to bases as a way to shore up its position. And the Philippines is also engaging in arms transfers with the regional states, including Japan, that will give it more capability. And I think one of the things I worry about with the Philippines, though, is a constant refrain that we hear in the Beltway, which is the capacity issue, is that we do want to build up the capacity of the Philippines, but it also depends on the extent to which the Philippines can absorb all of those capabilities. My fear is that we could potentially talk ourselves out of helping the Philippines if we keep banging the drum that the Philippines are somehow simply incapable or incompetent of absorbing those weapons. We have to be careful to certainly to acknowledge that there are limits to how much advanced weaponry the Philippines can absorb, but I think we have to be careful not to talk ourselves out of supplying the Philippines at all by saying that they can't, you know, they can't handle these weaponry. My sense is that the Philippines, when push comes to shove, will be very serious about their territorial defense, and that they care just about their homeland as much as any country in that part of the world. So, I would urge people looking at assistance to the Philippines not to over-underestimate Philippines' both will and capacity to defend its territory. And then with Japan, I think what's remarkable about Japan is that it's going through quite an impressive evolution in its thinking about national security, whether it's the issuing of its first national security strategy, the setup of institutions like the National Security Council that will streamline decision-making, whether it's the amendment, the reinterpretation of the Constitution to enable Japan to engage in limited, I would underscore, limited collective self-defense that enables Japan to engage in collective self-defense activities with its closest allies, namely the United States, but possibly others. These are all, I think, very important institutional changes that will make Japan an increasingly important contributor, a net contributor to security in the region. Japan is also providing defensive capabilities, providing arms to countries, the frontline states, including the Philippines, and interestingly, including India. And now we are hearing that Australia is in the final stages of deciding whether it wants to buy Japan's Soryu-class submarine, which is the world's best conventional diesel-electric submarine in the world. And so Japan is stepping up to the plate for all of these reasons. And Japan's also modernizing its military, but also reposturing itself. It's now going to reposture a lot of its force capabilities along the southwestern islands, the Ryukyu Islands, that basically enclose China around the East China Sea. The Ryukyu Islands stretches from the main island of Kyushu all the way to the northeastern tip of Taiwan. And this archipelago is often seen as an important gateway for China's naval and air forces. And so the Japanese are reposturing themselves to the south, essentially to slam the gates in the face of the Chinese, to close that gate to the Chinese. And so there's a lot that's happening in Japan. And then finally, Australia. We just saw the release of Australia's defense white paper, and it has used very, very blunt language to describe its security environment. And it seems that Australia is committed to modernizing its own military, including the submarine purchase, but also posturing itself so that it will be able to actively operate to its north. It's now, rather than contributing to U.S. operations, say, in the Middle East, Australia is also reposturing itself for a future in which it sees a much more competitive security environment to its north, namely China. So there's a lot that's going on in this part of the world, and frankly, as an analyst, it's very hard to keep track because of these dynamics. But I do want to say one more thing, which is America's regional relations in this part of the world. This is also going through a very important evolution. The United States, since the end of World War II, has traditionally relied on bilateral security alliances, right? The so-called San Francisco system, named after the San Francisco Peace Treaty that formed America's treaty relationship with Japan at the end of World War II. Well, that bilateral security architecture is evolving into a much more complex and in some ways much more resilient architecture. And what I mean by that is that the traditional hub-and-spoke architecture is evolving into one in which the United States is actively encouraging the spokes to form their own relations. So the United States is actively encouraging Japan and Australia, bilateral treaty alliances of the United States, to form closer relationships with each other. Japan is also being encouraged to engage South Korea to forge closer ties with another U.S. bilateral treaty ally. And the United States is pursuing a trilateral security architectures. So you can imagine now the development of a series of overlapping networks, trilateral relations between the U.S., Japan, and Australia, U.S., Japan, South Korea, U.S., Japan, India. There are all of these permutations of relations. And what we will be seeing, I believe, is an overlapping network of relations that will both be formal and informal, that will essentially tighten around China. And a lot of these relationships are forming as a response, not solely, but certainly as a part of a response to China's rise. And so while it's important for us to recognize the challenge that China poses to the region, it's also important not to underestimate the countervailing power against China's rise. And I think this is one of the sharpest comparative advantages that the United States has in the region, which is the quality friends and allies that it has in this part of the world. It is one of the asymmetric advantages, I think, that the United States must exploit, must leverage, if it really wants to be, if it wants to counterbalance China's rise. And it's a sharp asymmetry because the Chinese themselves acknowledge that China has low-quality friends, right? I mean, the only ally that it can claim is North Korea. Okay, that's the only true ally that it has. And the other client states that it has, like Cambodia or Laos or Pakistan, they're not serious powers. And of course, Myanmar, who used to be very close to China, has now reoriented itself towards the United States, something that was probably not quite thinkable a decade ago. So again, what we're seeing are a whole host of alignments that I would say overall favors the United States. So if you think about this competition as a long-term peacetime competition, then what we're seeing, I think, are several initial moves that are being made by both sides, and that we shouldn't draw any hasty conclusions about, whether China will ultimately get its way or not, because the United States has a lot of inherent structural strengths that it can leverage vis-a-vis China.
You know, a few years ago, you and James Holmes wrote a nice thing for the Naval Institute on the asymmetric warfare, American style, and China, and you talked about the cumulative warfare as opposed to, or cumulative strategy as opposed to the sequential. And is that cumulative strategy kind of what we're looking at as we see Marines being stationed in Australia, as we I don't know what we're going to do. I mean, you point out in one of your pieces about the Ryukyu Islands as being an ideal place to help, as you say, slam the door. But I mean, are these efforts that we're seeing now, are they part of a cumulative strategy that is actually being slowly put into place?
Yeah, I think this notion of a cumulative strategy is a very important component of America's countervailing strategy. And what's also important to note here is that China is also embarked on its own version of a cumulative strategy in peacetime, right, which is to gradually enhance its position in the maritime domain in ways that are not decisive in one particular move, but it's a series of small moves that create incremental dividends on behalf of the Chinese. The so-called, people have called it the salami slicing tactic or the cabbage strategy, whatever you want to call it. This incremental approach that adds incremental dividends to the Chinese is something that the Chinese are employing too. Now, from the perspective of the United States and its allies, I think the cumulative approach is one way to impose costs on on China. And let me just kind of recap the argument that Jim and I have made on this front. The notion is simply to seek to militarize certain portions of the Ryukyu Islands so that if the Chinese were to seek to conduct, say, an attack on Taiwan, that it would have to take into consideration this additional flank that's been created by the U.S.-Japan alliance, and that the Chinese, if they were to seek to create essentially a breakthrough through the Ryukyu Islands, they would have to divert some of their resources to creating an open corridor through the Ryukyus, and that diversionary effect that would have on China's campaign would raise costs to the Chinese. Now, probably not raise sufficient costs to defeat the Chinese or to deter the Chinese from acting in the first place. But the goal here is to impose costs on the Chinese such that we force more difficult choices on the Chinese. Because I think, in my view, we've permitted the Chinese to sort of operate in a frictionless environment where they've been pushing through open doors. What we need to do is to posture ourselves and our allies in such ways that China needs to now devote at least a proportion of its attention, of its force structure, of its capabilities at different parts of the theater so that it cannot devote all of its resources against one target, say, over Taiwan, and that this diversionary strategy will also allow the alliance to have incremental gains. So if the Chinese, for example, if you think about China's missile force or China's air force, if they have to devote a percentage of their ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, and their air sorties against targets on the Ryukyus, well, that's that's that percentage that the Chinese can no longer use against Taiwan. So the more of these types of diversionary costs that we can impose on China, the better. Because again, the goal here is not a war-winning strategy. It's simply, my analogy is kind of a spike strip. You know, you're laying down the spike strip to slow down the Chinese offensive. And so again, looking creatively about different types of systems and weaponry that would do so would again hopefully make the Chinese think twice. And so one of the weapon systems, one of the favorite weapon systems that I like talking about from the Japanese perspective, is their truck-mounted anti-ship cruise missiles that were originally designed for the Soviet Union against a Soviet amphibious invasion of the Hokkaido Island. Those missile units that are mobile, that are very accurate, fairly long range, could make, for example, large parts of the East China Sea a no-go zone for Chinese surface fleet. Again, that's another way of imposing costs on the Chinese. And if the Chinese were to try to eliminate that threat, they would have to devote air sorties, missiles, ballistic and cruise missiles against that target that would otherwise be devoted against Taiwan. So that's one illustration of how one could impose costs on China.
As we get near the end of the show, Toshi, I wanted to kind of look long range, as I like to call it, with China, the long game. And something that would probably make Admiral Huaqing proud is the fact you no longer have to be a Pacific nation to be focused or at least interested in Chinese naval power. For instance, one of our regular listeners here live from Turkey, Sim, he asked a question about last year Russia and China conducted a joint naval exercise in the Eastern Mediterranean. And is this something that people should expect more of, whether in partnership with the Chinese or in other nations? And or was this a one-off thing that it might take a few years before we see again?
Yeah, you're referring to basically China's relationship with Russia.
Right, and projecting together with them, if needed, outside of the Pacific Rim.
Yeah, I think Russia is kind of oftentimes the ignored player in the Western Pacific, but I think Russia actually plays an important role that has enabled China to do all of the things that it's been doing over the past decade. I think what we're seeing is a very interesting historical anomaly, at least from the perspective of China, which is that throughout Chinese history, it has always had to worry about its northern frontier, right? Whether it's the nomads that came crashing into the Chinese heartland and so on, all the way through to the Soviets' threat to the Chinese in the 60s into the 70s. Well, China has not had to worry about that over the past two decades since the end of the Cold War. And it is that ability to divert its attention from the north to the maritime domain that has enabled China to invest in its maritime and aerospace capabilities. And so, in some ways, the absence of enmity between Russia and China today is what has enabled China to focus in the maritime aerospace domain. Now, so the question is, will this relationship between Russia and China, this friendship, remain in place indefinitely? I have my doubts. I mean, if you look at history, Russia and China are in some ways natural enemies. And, of course, because of the dramatic demographic shifts, the Russian Far East is literally emptying out, and China, of course, has historic claims in that part of Siberia. It is possible that Sino-Russian enmity may arise again. And if the One Belt, One Road plan goes ahead and, for example, it triggers a security dilemma between China and Russia, that could very well change China's game plan, that it would once again have to pay more attention to its north. And that also will have a diversionary effect in terms of how many resources it can devote to the maritime domain. So unfortunately, because of our poor relations with Russia today, we really can't play the Russia card. You know, we can't be Bismarckian about this. You know, we have to be, in opposition to Russia in terms of its ambitions in Europe and the Middle East and with China. And I think it is because of this larger geostrategic alignment that has allowed China to focus its attention in the maritime domain. So I think at least in the near to medium term, we should see continued sort of marriage of convenience between China and Russia. And that means that they're married in this marriage of convenience with an eye towards the United States.
Wow. We've used up our hour here, Toshi, and I really appreciate you being on with us today. It's been fascinating. I'm sure we could go on for several more hours, and if we can get you back, we will go on for several more hours. Is there anything we can look forward to coming from you in the next few weeks or months you'd like to talk about before we let you go?
You mean things to look forward to down the road in terms of forecasting what China might do?
Well, no, I was thinking of, I'd like to know that too, but if you've got any articles or other, another book coming out or something that you'd like to plug right now, now's a good time.
Sure. I'd like to plug a recent article that will be coming out through the Naval War College Review. It's a historical campaign assessment of the Paracels battle in 1974 between China and South Vietnam. And in that article, I make some very interesting parallels to what the Chinese are doing today in terms of China's use of paramilitary forces. And that's one of the interesting findings, that even 40 years ago, the Chinese made very excellent use of paramilitary forces, this really clever use of civil-military integration of forces to push the South Vietnamese out of the Paracel Islands. So this notion that the Chinese are using white hulls in the South China Sea is less of a novelty, but something of a continuity. The Chinese have been using those forces in those ways for quite some time. So thank you for this opportunity to plug my article.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for coming on our show.
Great. Thank you.
And thanks a lot from here as well, Toshi. Always a pleasure to have you. And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. And I ask you to join us again next Sunday, where our guest will be Corey Dauber. She's a professor of communication from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where we will be discussing visual propaganda and extremism online. Until then, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
goodbye, Piccadilly. Farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary.